Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily Digest. I'm Ben Olson, that's Nathan Fox. Together we're the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT. Here's what we talked about this week.
Hello, I recently graduated in May and I am applying to law school in the fall. I took an LSAT in March but got caught up with school and couldn't study well. I got a 153 but canceled it, which I should have just kept looking back now. I last scored a 160 on a practice exam after studying for 3 weeks using LSAT Demon. Well, I wouldn't regret that cancel. I mean, we never recommend people cancel.
Yeah, but you're not going to use that 153 for anything.
That 153 and a cancel are the same thing. It doesn't matter one way or the other. You're going to get a 160 something or maybe even 170 something. And that cancel / 153 are just not going to be part of your, I mean, it's on your record, but the law schools don't have to report it to the ABA, so they don't care.
Yep.
I find that I always run out of time near the end of the sections and get the last five or so wrong because of the time. I am taking my LSAT in August and aiming for the 170s. Whoa. And I believe my pace is keeping me from that. So I was wondering, how do you suggest getting better at that? Want to stop there and give some advice to Anonymous?
Yeah, I mean, we encounter this all the time, and it's probably because you've only been with the demon for 3 weeks. But your problem is not time. Your problem is understanding the questions that you're getting to. As you understand them better, you will get faster. So it's not about like, oh, I need more time. It's I need a better understanding of the questions I'm doing.
Yeah. The only way to go fast on the LSAT is by accident. If you're doing it right, you're going to be calmly solving each question and you get so good at it that it just doesn't take you much time. On the games, you really solve the system and then you just answer all the questions back to back to back, no problem, without hardly doing any work because you already did that work up front in your setup. On logical reasoning, you're predicting the answer. Reading comp, you're predicting the answer. And then the wrong answers just start to look like trash. And then you go faster and faster accidentally. But it's not because you're pushing for speed. And pushing for speed, ironically, is going to have the exact opposite. You're going to make a bunch of casual mistakes. You're also going to misread things. You're not going to see the shortcuts. You're going so fast that you're going to miss the shortcuts. And then the test is going to just seem difficult.
And by shortcuts, Nathan is talking about an understanding of what's being said fundamentally. It's not like some like, oh, trick or gimmick. It's like, right. Oh, I know what they just said. The first words that are in this answer choice cannot logically be consistent with what was said. So I am done. That's a shortcut. And you're not reading the rest of the answer choice and you're saving time.
Yeah, students are slow because they spend so much time comparing wrong answer choices to one another. Mm-hmm. And experts are fast because they take all the time they need to understand the argument, understand the setup of the game, understand the passage in reading comp, really read and really understand and synthesize the information that's there and try to predict the answers to the questions. And then on the wrong answers, it's like, what? No, nope, nope. Oh, yeah, there we go. D. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, you've done 80% of the work before you ever even read answer choice A. Students do it the other way around. They spend 80% of their time comparing wrong answers to one another. And it's just, boy, much more difficult, much more time consuming, and not nearly as fun. Yeah. As knowing what you're looking for and predicting the answer. So you got to stop worrying about speed. You just got to go deep and focus on accuracy. Anonymous continues, also, I switched from pre-med to pre-law very late because I realized it is not what I wanted to do. So I was a biology major and graduated with only a 3.67 because I found my bio courses to be very challenging. Would a high LSAT score help make up for this and give me a shot at good law schools? period. It was like one big long run-on sentence with a question at the end, but a period. Thank you. That's from Anonymous. What do you have to say about all that?
Just go to lsidemon.com/scholarships, put in your 3.67 GPA, and start seeing what different LSAT scores will do for you when it comes to scholarships. That's how you determine how well an LSAT score can compensate for your low GPA.
Yeah, and 3.67 is not shockingly low at all. And you'll write a one-sentence addendum pointing to an increasing grade trend, possibly, after you switched majors.
Yeah, don't call it an increasing grade trend. Just say it was whatever, right?
Switched majors and my GPA was 4.0 after I did that.
Yep.
Or I don't know. Yeah, when I switched to pre-law, my GPA was this.
Yeah.
I don't know. Something. Just one sentence. And then, but you've got to have the LSAT that's going to make them actually look at it. I'm a little worried that Anonymous says, I am taking my LSAT in August.
Kind of suggesting that this person is planning on only one attempt. You should really be planning on two. If you knock it out of the park and you get the highest score you could possibly imagine your first attempt, great, you're done. But that's not the norm because of variance.
And even if you do score 170 on that first, on that August attempt, I mean, if your practice tests indicate that you can score 174, then you should definitely take it again. So
yeah,
you should be considering multiple overlapping tests, probably plan to take it in August, September, and October, especially if you think you're going to apply. Well, you say I am applying to law school in the fall, so I'm glad you're shooting for August. And you should also be taking September and October. You need to treat August as if it's just another practice test. The best way to do that is to have it literally be a practice test for your September and, you know, October exams, which you're gonna take.
With me today is Carl Lasker. He is a Yale, what are you? You're a rising 2L?
Yeah, rising 2L.
Okay. A rising 2L at Yale, a LSAT demon teacher, and just all around good guy. Today, I asked you to come on the show, Carl, and thanks for making the time to do it, because you taught a class on Tuesday called LR Mastery, right? And anyone who takes a class in the demon, they can leave feedback. They can leave like a 1 to 5 star rating, and then they can comment if they want to. Whenever people do that, we end up getting that feedback so we can try to make all the classes better. And this one came in, and it came in anonymously, but it said, you know, it gave you a five star rating, which is great. But the comment said, Carl's LR class was the best one I've attended on the demon. So, you know, that's pretty good, Carl. It's the best class ever for this person. He offers lucid explanations for each answer choice of each problem and is loaded with effective strategies. How do you feel so far?
I'm loving what Anonymous has to say.
This is a great podcast episode, right? It's all about...
Yeah, well, I think the context is that I taught with the demon for a year, actually. And then I took a break for law school. And so when I came back,
yeah,
all the students were new to me, and I could kind of rapid fire through every strategy I had, and it would be like completely new information, right? So I had like this year of experience, but then no one knew who I was because I was away for so long. And so it almost felt like a greatest hit show during the class a little bit.
You had all this buildup you wanted to share, and you didn't feel like you're repeating yourself from just the week prior or something.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, it's similar information to what other instructors say, but presented differently. Yeah. And then some things just click with certain people, maybe.
So this review continues. I've been applying one of the LR reading strategies that he oh so nonchalantly dropped in class, and it has not only helped me in LR, but also RC. After implementing that reading approach, I feel so much more confident in tackling LR and RC. Okay, well, you know, to be honest, we get a lot of these sort of positive reviews. Sometimes, of course, we get negative ones, and we want to figure out what happened and try to make the class better. But, you know, this person seemed particularly excited about one of the LR reading strategies that you shared in class. So I was like, hey, I forwarded this to you. And I said, Carl, do you know what specifically you said? And you sent me back three possible ideas because you weren't totally sure.
Yeah,
and the first one started.
Not,
but... Okay, so maybe it's not even one of those. But the first one had to do with Mario. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe we should just share this on the Demon Daily podcast. Do you want to start with that one and what you were trying to say? See if you can like articulate that.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I was trying to say that LR and RC are exactly like Super Mario.
Okay.
And there's no difference. No,
I think you're going to need some evidence for that, but go for it.
Yeah, sure. So I guess this is all contingent on people kind of remembering those old Super Mario games where Mario is kind of running through something and jumping on mushrooms and collecting coins. And then every once in a while, Mario will pass a flagpole. And when Mario jumps past the flagpole, a flag goes up.
Yep.
And then if something happens to Mario further down the road, I forget what can happen to Mario. But if something happens to Mario, Mario doesn't start again at the beginning of the game. And Mario doesn't start again, or Mario doesn't just keep going. Mario returns to that flagpole and then keeps going from there. So kind
of
like,
okay, I do remember.
Jumps
this
back to the middle.
These are classic 2D games, right? Where you're only running from left to right. That's your only way to win this game. And at the very end of each level, there was that flagpole, and you had to like run up the stairs, and then you were trying to get to the top of that flagpole.
Were you? Okay.
Yeah, because if you got to the top, you got more points. If you jumped up and were halfway up the flagpole, then you didn't get as many points. But then the level would end, right? He would like go into some tunnel. Next level, and if you died in that level, you'd respawn. I don't know that they had that word back then, but you'd respawn back at that flag.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's kind of like, I think, LR and RC, because we also read left to right, and we're moving in that direction.
What else do you do left to right?
But I think what's important is that I think on the LSAT, a lot of students will feel... I think there's a lot of perverse incentives on the LSAT because there's this ticking clock. And so people feel a lot of pressure from the time. Yep. And then I think a lot of students will know that they are going to have to answer a question at the end, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of students think, well, if I have this ticking clock and I know I need to get to the question and I can't even collect points in the passage, I think I need to zoom through the passage to read the question and then I'll figure out what's going on in the answer choices. Or I'll kind of reverse engineer once I see the answer choices and work through it, because I know going through five answer choices is already going to take me a lot of time and I have to go through all five. There's just not enough time to go through the passage too. And I think the tricky thing about that is that students are missing the fact that if they engage more with the passage up front, then they'll spend less time in the answer choices. And this is kind of blending a few of my strategies, I'm realizing, as I talk about it. But I think it all is important in that I think what we need to do is read to understand and not skip anything. But that also means that we can't push through the end if we don't understand what we've read before it. And so I think a lot of times we talk at the Demon about how you should never finish reading a sentence and not know what's going on and then keep reading the next one. You should always know what you've read in the past before starting the next sentence in LR or the next sentence in RC. And so that's where the idea of Super Mario Brothers comes in, right? I imagine as I'm reading through, I'm understanding, and I'm putting everything into context. And then sometimes I'll reach a point where maybe I zoned out, or maybe I am just, it's too dense and I don't understand what's going on. And then I'm kind of at a crossroads as a reader where I can keep going and push through to the end and not really understand, or I can kind of return back to the middle of the passage. And so some students will return to the beginning, some students will read all the way through. I think the best way to do it is to kind of read each sentence one at a time, understand, and then when you reach the end of each sentence, treat it as a flag post in Super Mario and a new checkpoint. And so as I'm reading, I'm kind of going, okay, I understand everything up until this period, and then I start the next sentence, right, as one does. And then if I realize I'm not understanding, instead of pushing through, I jump back in the passage to the last point at which I know I understand everything ahead of this, but once I move past this, I got lost, and I keep reading from there until I understand. And so I think it's so important because I'm not saying that if you don't understand something, you have to reread all the things that you already do understand, but I am saying if you find yourself not understanding something, you should go back and reread that section, or go back to the point at which you know what comes before and keep reading from there, so that you're not jumping into a third and a fourth sentence without knowing what comes in the first and the second sentence. Because, I mean, if you're confused after sentence two, it's only going to get worse by the time you're sentence four. Else that's going to drag you all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's kind of what I had in mind when I'm talking about Super Mario Bros.
No, it's, I mean, and if you're really doing it right, then your previous checkpoint should be no more than one sentence away, right?
Yeah, or even one clause. Like, yeah, for checkpoints, I'm thinking, yeah, punctuation marks primarily.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, it's true. That's commas, semicolons, right? These punctuation marks that the LSAT likes to use. It's like, hey, if you feel like the passage, or I shouldn't even say passage, if you feel like the sentence is getting away from you, then that's fine. Just stop there. There's no one saying, hey, you need to read that entire sentence before you can take stock of it and figure out what it means. Like, you can plant that flagpole halfway through that sentence and be like,
yeah, okay, exactly,
I get it now, and let's go on. So it's almost like you came up with this idea because people were seeing the questions, or are seeing the questions, as rewards, right? Or like that's where the money is, so to speak. And it's like, no, actually the money is all through the passage. You just have to realize that it's there and collect those points as you're going through the passage.
Yeah, and I think I also, like, when I began studying myself for the LSAT way back when, back when it was paper and pencil, if you can believe I did the same thing. And so, because I knew that it would take me a while to go through the five answer choices, no matter how much time I spent on the passage. And this was particularly tricky for me on reading comp, because the passages are longer. Mm-hmm. But I kind of almost knew, like, well, I have this time that I'm going to have to spend on the questions. It's probably going to be the same amount of time, no matter what. So maybe I can save time by reducing it in the passage. But again, it's not the same amount of time no matter what. And once I realized that I'd spend less time in the answer choices if I spent more time in the passage, I really got faster, because there's five answer choices and some of them are long, and there's one passage, and the passage is your best friend. So I would much rather slow down to speed up, read the one passage, to then save time reading the five answer choices.
Absolutely. Okay, cool. Hey, another thing you mentioned in your email when you responded to me was you said that the beginning of the passage is harder or something like that.
Yeah, I would go a step further as to say, I think that the first sentence you read in every passage is the hardest sentence.
Sure.
And the reason I think that is because before you read the first sentence, you have no idea what you're going to read. You could be reading about helicopters, you could be reading about killer whales, you could be reading about Super Mario running past flagpoles. I mean, it could be anything.
Anything. And often these topics are unfamiliar to people who are reading them, right, for the first time.
Yeah.
It's like some painting technique from the 1700s. It's like no one has ever cared or thought about that before. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes also I feel like I just would sometimes have trouble transitioning. And so I might not even be in the passage when I first start reading the first sentence. Like, I may start reading kind of passively and then realize I'm not actually, I'm reading the words, but they're not entering my brain. And I think that's way more likely to happen to me in sentence one than in sentence three, when I'm already kind of reading and understanding. And so I would, like, very often read the first sentence twice. And I think I'd get nervous about that, because I'd, again, be like, I have to get to the end of the passage. There's this perverse time pressure on me, and I'm spending so much time in the beginning that I don't even know what the passage is talking about. But what I think I failed to realize is that the first sentence is so difficult because I can't predict what's going to come in the first sentence.
Yeah.
I can't put it in context of what comes before. Whereas after each sentence you read, after each Mario checkpoint you pass, you have that much more information to predict what's going to come next. And that much more context to put the next sentence in. And so what I found is that on, like, RC, first sentence, hardest sentence, first paragraph, hardest paragraph. Mm. And if I really spent a lot of time in the very beginning, figured out what the topic was and what the argument might be, then by the time I'm reaching the last sentence, or by the time I'm reaching even the last paragraph on reading comp, a lot of times I already know what the whole thing is going to say. And so I'm making all that time back and more by engaging more at the very beginning when I don't have context. And then I'm allowing that context to help me predict what is going to come down the road. And so I think I say this because a lot of students will, especially on reading comp, actually get into, like, the third or fourth paragraph, and that's when they'll start slowing down and trying to understand because they'll realize they're confused. But then, like we talked about earlier, at this point, like, in theory, if you're using the Mario checkpoints, you're never going a sentence or two ahead. At this point, people sometimes are three or four sentences down the line, and so it can be like a little more confusing about where do I jump back to? I don't really understand what's going on. And that's because you're trying to start investing time mid-passage without having built up an understanding of what the passage is actually talking about.
Yeah, it's almost like the Mario checkpoints. You remember, you had to jump to the top to get the most points. And if you ran right from the top of the stairs and, you know, jumped at the right place, you could get to the top of that flagpole. Otherwise, you get to the middle or whatever. And it's almost like the flagpoles earlier on in the passage are taller and you need to make the effort to like really hit the top of that flagpole. And if you do and you get it, then all the other flagpoles start to get shorter. If you don't do it, though, they actually start to get taller, I think. Like carry these assumptions right with you where, no, not in the actual game. I'm just saying like.
Oh, in this. Yeah, no, 100%.
We're going.
Too much Mario.
Yeah, too much Mario. But the point is that like you're saying, if you're not investing in that first sentence and in the second sentence and in the first paragraph, then you not only get confused later because you don't have the information that they expect you to have, you're also bringing in all these assumptions. Like when people miss stuff, they start putting in their own assumptions of what they think the author is saying. And it's the kind of assumptions that I don't know how the test writers do this, but they almost seem to anticipate what these people are going to.
Yeah, it is really
assume.
Interesting.
And then the questions, you know, like leverage that or pry on that or what is it? I don't know if that's the right.
Yeah, I mean, they take advantage of maybe like the worst thing I think you can feel as a test taker is stress that you're looking at the clock counting down and thinking, oh, I'm still in the third sentence of the passage, because then you're thinking that you need to race much further ahead when, and then it's actually going to take you longer to go through the passage. And then it's going to take you far longer to then like try and solve the question by reading each answer choice and comparing it back to the passage instead of actually already knowing, having a prediction about what a correct answer is going to look like and then going and identifying it within the five choices.
Yeah. I wanted to share one idea with you that I've been, it's another analogy, a totally different one, but, I've been helping my oldest son with the SAT, right? And one thing that he'll do is he'll read a sentence and I'm telling him this, right? Dude, you got to understand these sentences. It's not about the questions. It's about the passage and understanding each sentence, exactly like what we've been talking about. And he'll read a sentence and then I'll ask him like, okay, what is that telling you and what can you get out of that? And it seems like universally his interpretation of that sentence is, I don't know if accurate's the right word, but it's accurate but incomplete. It's like there are words in the sentence that he's glossing over, not extracting the information from that word that would clue you in a little bit more. Right. Like there is one sentence we were looking at and the author was talking about going to see her friends to console them. Right. And when I said, hey, what did that sentence say? He said something like, oh, she's trying to go back home. And there was more in the sentence, but trying to go back home to see her friends. I was like, yeah, OK, that's true. But like, why? And it's like, oh, to console them. And it's like, what can you extract from that word console? And eventually it's like, oh, well, maybe something bad happened, right? But that idea wasn't in his head. And so I'm like, you've got to like grapple with each word and then try to squeeze as much juice out of that word and sentence as you can. Otherwise you're like leaving these inferences or I don't know, these clues on the table. Right. And you're just moving on into the next sentence.
Yeah. And well, I think one thing that I found on the LSAT too is that one thing they love to do is say something once in a pretty straightforward way and then revisit the same idea later on in a much more complicated phrasing. And so a lot of times maybe they'll say that this person was seeing their friends and consoling them in like sentence one, and then they'll revisit the idea later on, but they will describe it in a way that might not be super obvious. that that's what they're talking, where it, you know, it might not be obvious that's what they're talking about later on. And it'll be very obvious to the person who read that they were consoling a friend and mm-hmm. understood that, because they can already kind of predict that that's what we're talking about. But yep. to somebody else, when they add in the more complicated phrasing of the same concept, suddenly you're struggling to understand at the later point when it's not just spelled out for you. And so I think that's, you know, another added danger of not picking up those extra words. I get how it happens, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, also if you recognize, like, oh, console, they don't say it in the sentence, but obviously something must have happened. Like, you don't go console people just to console them, you know? It's like, so something happened. And then when they talk about that later, you almost see it as two separate events. It's like, okay, we had this person going to see their friends, and then we had this like bad thing that happened, and you're not putting them together. It's like, or you don't even know, like you said, they use convoluted language. So you don't even realize that it's something that's bad that happened, and that it's the thing that probably prompted their friends to need consoling. Right. And it's like, you're just not putting the dots together. Reading is understanding each sentence, but also understanding how they relate to each other. And you can't do that if you don't understand the initial sentence.
No.
Anyways, thanks, Carl. Do you have any last words of advice?
No, I don't think I do. I think everybody's okay. got all the advice they need from, I mean, anything I trumpet is going to be coming pretty much from you and Nathan. Just revisit. I guess, actually, maybe real quick,
yeah.
I can share one other idea that I had for what that, you know, I forget what they called it. A nonchalantly dropped strategy might have been that kind of relates to this idea of like predicting what comes next. But I do want to take a second, and I'll only take a second, to talk about like the value of transition words in these passages.
Sure.
Because transition words were my best friend as a reader, particularly however. I love however. And the reason that I love however, but really any transition word, furthermore, you know, any of those, is that every time I see that word, I know exactly what's going to come after it, because it's the word is like referencing the sentence that came before it. And so if I've read and understood a sentence that says maybe like, I am running out of time to pick up groceries this week or something, I don't know. And then I see a however, I know that the next sentence is going to just say something to the opposite effect of what I expect if I'm running out of time to pick up groceries. Like, however, maybe I was able to ask a friend to do it. Or however, maybe I have enough groceries. It's something that's going to be, you know, the opposite.
Sure.
And so a lot of times I found on the LSAT, the first sentence will be pretty straightforward. Then they'll drop a transition word and they'll follow it up with a doozy. but what's really nice is that I think if someone's reading intentionally and methodically, they should know what's going to come next. And so they already know the meaning of that very complicated doozy sentence.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot easier to work your way through a sentence that's complicated if you already know what it's trying to tell you. Like, it's like, you know, the answer, you just don't know how they're going to get to the answer.
Yeah.
And so it's much easier to understand something when you see the answer than it is to understand something when you have no idea what they're trying to tell you. And so the other thing I'd say to people is transition words are your best friends, but you know, slow down to speed up. You have to make two mistakes and miss a question. All the greatest hits are things that I'd recommend people do, but the best thing people can do is kind of trust the process and, you know, keep studying with the demon.
We have an email here from Daisha.
Hey, Ben and Nathan, I hope you guys are well. Last weekend, I took the June LSAT, and thanks to you guys and the demon, I felt more confident than ever. I heard some interesting statistics on the recent LSATs and wanted to hear your guys' opinion. On the PowerScore podcast, they talked about how the number of test takers has declined this spring. They talked about how the number of test takers on the June 2022 test was 50% less than the number on the June 2021 test. They said that this means that the cycle may not be as competitive, which is surprising to me because I know we're on the brink of a recession. And I remember when you guys said that bad economic situations usually lead to more post-grad admissions. Not only have we said that, but we're just repeating what many economists have pointed out for years. So, that's not just our opinion. What do you think about the decline of test takers? What do you think this means for those of us applying in September? Sorry if this is long. You guys are my LSAT dads. I don't think I've ever been given that name before. on this podcast, and I need your opinion. Thank you for everything.
Thanks, Dacia.
thank you. Honestly, I don't think about this stuff. Like, it is what it is. You're going to have the competitiveness that you're going to get whenever you apply. You still want to apply with the best LSAT score you can possibly get and the best GPA you can possibly get. To me, that never changes.
Yeah, I think it's a waste of time to think about, a waste of time to speculate about. Dacia, you don't need our opinion on this. You need your very best LSAT score,
mm-hmm.
along with your very best grades, so that you can put your best foot forward, so that you can get the best offers that are available for you this cycle.
Yeah,
I mean, if it turns out to be a less competitive cycle, fine. If it turns out to be a more competitive cycle, who gives a shit? Because you're going to be a kick-ass applicant. I don't know. Like, so, you know, what are they doing? Are they like, so hurry up and sign up for our class now so that you can take advantage of this less competitive cycle? That seems like the only possible value from that. I don't know. Like, Dacia, don't rush into anything.
Yeah.
Just because this is a less competitive cycle, if it actually is. I mean, based on the scores that we see from our students, it looks like it's going to be a more competitive cycle. Like, maybe there's going to be fewer people taking the test, but they're going to be kicking the living shit out of it.
We must be getting a bias, like, reporting or something. Every time someone reports, come to us. Well, I don't know what it is. It's just like people, you know, even on the show we just recorded, it's like a 173, a 178. It's like, okay, how many people can be up here and these scores still maintain their, you know, selectivity, which is the whole point of them.
Could be selectivity. It could be that more people come to us now, you know, they improve more.
I don't know. Yeah.
I just don't know, Dacia. I have no idea. This is the first I've ever even heard of there being a decline. I wasn't even aware that that was a thing. Were you, Ben?
I did notice this. I saw the numbers about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah,
I mean, it's just like, okay, that happened. What?
Things are like full steam at LSAT Demon. That's all I know. Yeah. Like we're busy. So, hey, this sounds like nothing but good news for you if you're applying this cycle. But if you're not ready to apply this cycle, do not force in a bad application early just because you think it might be also, hey, law schools need to cut down their classes, don't they? Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like, in order for law schools to maintain prestige, they need to have smaller classes. And so if they have poor applicants, you know, if there are fewer people taking the test and there are fewer people applying, law schools could very sensibly go, oh, OK, so maybe we won't admit 500 people anymore. Maybe we'll just admit 400 people this year and keep our standards high.
Yep.
One would like to think that they would do that. So, you know, a less competitive cycle might not really translate to anything beneficial to individual applicants.
Except maybe at the bottom, which right. We don't care about. Yeah.
Right. Which at the bottom, you just shouldn't be. Just shouldn't be going. Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Nathan Fox. With me today is Francesca Civilotti. Francesca is one of our teachers at LSATdemon.com. Francesca also helps do a whole bunch of stuff on the back end, including responding to students via our ask button. Francesca, you brought this email from the ask button to the show. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. It's mostly Dylan who does ask button stuff these days, but I did hop on and I saw this one and I thought it was kind of interesting because it sounds a lot like questions that I get pretty often about the same thing or about similar things. But basically the student was wondering whether we could clarify the sentence, do you agree with it, when we ask students to evaluate logical reasoning arguments. We say, well, what do you think about it? Do you agree with this argument? And the student said, I'm not sure if this is a trivial thing that I picked up, but I thought the purpose of evaluating an argument is to look at it objectively. Whether I agree with it or not, or whether I find it valid, has nothing to do with me choosing the correct answer.
So just to be clear with our listeners, this is a relatively narrow area of logical reasoning. It's one type of logical reasoning question We call it an evaluate question. The question it'll present an argument, and then the question will say, which one of the following would be most useful to know in order to evaluate the argument? Or it'll say, which one of the following questions would be most helpful in evaluating the argument? So that's what we're talking about here, is an evaluate question for logical reasoning. And you're telling me, Francesca, that sometimes in your classes, you'll say, well, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about the argument? You'll ask that to a student.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that this isn't quite, it doesn't just apply to evaluate questions, I'd say, because of course, evaluate questions are going to ask students to evaluate the argument and say, you know, what do they actually think about it? But I think that just as a practice, when we're dealing with logical reasoning passages, if they're arguments, we want to ask ourselves, what do I think about it? Is this a good argument? Do I agree? Is this does it hold water? Or is it an invalid argument? So I would say this is something that we're doing on pretty much every argument that shows up on logical reasoning. And yeah, it's confusing because there is a sense of, okay, well, I need to argue to deal with this argument on its face, objectively. So my personal opinions shouldn't matter. But I would say that that's a misunderstanding of what it means for an argument to be valid or invalid. Because whether it's valid or invalid is actually an objective question, right? Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're always attacking arguments. We're always evaluating arguments. That's something that we should be doing naturally and constantly. And we should be doing that before we ever know that this is an evaluate question. I mean, yeah, evaluate, by the way, is a pretty rare question type. I mean, I would guess that it's something like 5% of all the questions turn out to be formally evaluate questions. But we're constant, nonstop evaluating the arguments. And we're essentially, what you're doing, if you're doing it right, you're just expecting the argument to be bullshit. And you're gonna try to tell them why it's bullshit. Now, the question could end up asking you to strengthen the argument or weaken the argument or identify a flaw in the argument or identify an assumption of the argument. Or maybe it just asks you, what was the conclusion of that argument or what was a method of reasoning that they used in that argument? But it doesn't really matter because I'm always just gonna be attacking the argument. And I'm essentially saying, hey, what's your evidence? What's your conclusion? And unless your evidence fully justifies your conclusion, like just makes it unavoidable, then I'm always going to be saying, well, you know, this is potentially bullshit because this evidence doesn't really necessarily justify this conclusion. So I am in the process of evaluating that argument. Yeah, so this student is like, well, but what I think about it isn't really relevant, but it absolutely is, because it's your opinion of the logic of the argument, which exactly. You said, Francesca, is a matter of fact.
I would say yes, whether an argument is logically valid or not is something that can objectively be determined. For example, if the author is making an argument about whether or not, you know, Fridays are a fun day, it doesn't matter whether you think that Fridays are a fun day or not, but it matters whether you agree that the author has proven or failed to prove that Fridays are a fun day or not. That's the difference.
Yeah, I wonder if we can flesh this out. This is kind of hard when we try to make up arguments on the fly or make up, you know, LSAT questions on the fly. But if the conclusion was, therefore, Friday is a fun day, and, you know, if their evidence had been something like, well, on Friday, it's karaoke.
Yeah, you know? I would say that's not a valid argument because you haven't made the connection between it being karaoke day and it being a fun day. Maybe you hate karaoke. Maybe karaoke is your worst nightmare.
Right. If it was like Friday's karaoke day, therefore it's a fun day for Nathan, then, you know, you would. So before you even get to the question, you would be like, well, wait a second now. Is Nathan the type of guy who likes karaoke? I mean, so you're asking that question already, right? You're like, this is potentially bullshit because Do we know if Nathan likes karaoke? You're necessarily assuming that Nathan likes karaoke. To strengthen this argument, we would add the fact Nathan likes karaoke. To weaken this argument, we would add the fact Nathan hates karaoke. And then when it turns out to be an evaluate question, you know, which one of the following would be a useful piece of information to help us evaluate the argument? Yeah, it's a matter of fact that we need to know whether or not Nathan likes karaoke.
Yeah, I would love the piece of information that I'd love to know there is, does Nathan enjoy singing drunk in front of a bunch of strangers?
Yeah, and the answer to that is going to be decidedly no, absolutely not. I think that, yeah, we did it. We managed to do it, Francesca. Good job. We came up with an example of an argument that was incomplete because we had a premise, Friday is karaoke day, and a conclusion, therefore it's a fun day for Nathan. And we, you know, it's just not, the argument has a missing piece in it. And no matter what type of question it turns out to be, you attack that argument, you say, hey, wait a second now, let's think this through. I don't really think you've gotten there yet. We need to know this thing. And then, yeah, no matter what type of question it turns out to be, that missing piece of information is going to be the answer. Yeah. When it's an evaluate question formally, it's like, it's really just like, hey, what do you need to know?
Yeah. To circle back to this student's question, and I mean, tell me if you disagree, but how I would put this the most succinctly, I would say is, I don't care about how you feel about the conclusion. About the thing that is being tried to be the thing that you're trying to prove, but I care about how you feel about the argument and how you got to that conclusion.
Yeah, we're not asking you for your opinion of whether Nathan likes karaoke. Mm. We're asking you, when we say, what do you think about that argument? We're asking you what you think about the logic of the argument. So does the premise Friday is karaoke day justify the conclusion, therefore, it's a fun day for Nathan? And you need to be able to say, well, I don't even know who Nathan is, but we need to know if we're evaluating this argument. And by the way, both teams should be doing this, right? Like if you're the prosecution or if you're the defense, you should be looking at that argument and going, well, clearly the thing that's missing here. And this is like an issue spotting, you know, this is very law school, by the way. This is like exactly what you're going to be doing on your exams in law school. You're going to be spotting the issue. You're going to be going, well, the critical thing we need to know here is whether Nathan likes karaoke. Mm-hmm. And you spot that, and then the question that they ask you, you've already answered it before they even ask you the question. And that's really when you're doing logical reasoning the easy way.
Totally.
Cool. Thanks for bringing this to the show. Anything else you want to say about it before we wrap it up?
I don't think so. Good luck studying to the student who wrote this in.
Yeah, it's easier than you think, you know, like you should be. I think frequently on an evaluate question, you're sort of predicting it before you even read the question. Right. You're just attacking the argument, and it's not a surprise when they say, hey, what's the piece of information that we really need to know? Because you should have, as a lawyer, already spotted, yeah, here's the piece of information that we need to know.
Yeah, I think it's important to just double click on the fact that we're doing this on pretty much every question. This is why we don't teach in terms of question types, is because the process is the same. Whatever the question's going to ask,
yeah,
you,
that's
you want
an interesting...
to dig into the argument.
Yeah, so you just said something that I like. You said we don't, well, I want to clarify a little bit. You said we don't teach in terms of question types. And that's slightly wrong because question types do matter. Like the difference between a sufficient assumption question and a necessary assumption question, It's two different types of questions that they're asking you. And you might need to learn a little bit of the theory, you know, behind the organization of the test. But you're absolutely 100% right that we don't lead with question types. We're not reading the question first. We're always reading the argument first because that's the easy way. You know, why don't you read the question first? Because it's just easier not to. All right. It's easier to attack these arguments, know what's missing. And then when we see, then it's just answer the question. I mean, what are they asking you? And yeah, mm-hmm. the questions that they ask you fall into these types. And yeah, the types do differ from one another. And you can learn some stuff about question types. But we're never thinking about that first, because we can so frequently predict the answer before we ever even mess with the question. Like, knowing that this is an evaluate question would not have helped me in assessing the weakness in the argument. Mm-hmm. Right? Same thing, by the way, if it's a strengthen question, or it's a weaken question, whatever. I don't need to know whose team I'm playing for. I need to know, you know, let's look at the battleground. The argument is the field of battle, right? And so mm-hmm. why not just see what's going on in the battle? Then if it says, well, you're playing for this team, you know what you would do, or you're playing for that team, you know what you would do. But it's just not helpful to know the question first, because we should always be evaluating the argument first. Elijah says, hey, Ben and Nathan, I'm a big fan of your common sense approach to the LSAT and always find your podcast refreshingly honest and direct. Thanks, Elijah. That's nice. I'm hoping to get some honest and direct advice of my own as I continue how I want to approach the law school application process. For context, I'm going into my junior year as an undergraduate student and am considering two paths to law school. I currently have a 4.0 GPA at a top 20 undergraduate university and scored a 165 on my LSAT diagnostic.
Whoa. Oh, shit.
I'll be studying for the LSAT using the Demon this late summer and fall in hopes of taking the test before I depart for study abroad in the spring of 2023. As for my two options that I'm considering, the first would be applying to Harvard through their junior deferral program. I would apply in my junior spring, as is required for the program, and could only apply there at that point, which we just hate that. Yeah. I just hate it. You sound like a kick-ass candidate.
It's interesting. They don't let you apply anywhere else.
Yeah.
Unless you get rejected, I guess, right?
If you get rejected, then you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
If I were lucky enough to be accepted, Elijah says, I would essentially be locked into taking 2 years off of work and then attending Harvard. Sorry, 2 years off to work and then attending Harvard. Isn't that interesting, Ben?
Yeah, they make you work.
The junior deferral program, they actually want you to work for 2 years. You know, partially what they're doing is they're just planning out their classes way in advance. This allows them to have more certainty about their class sizes.
They've
in the
booked
future.
People in, right? They've locked booked, you in.
This is great for Harvard. This is excellent for Harvard. I don't know how good this is for you, Elijah.
They've cherry picked the best students.
Yeah, and they probably
get
don't
on
need,
the market.
Yeah. They know they're not going to give you a scholarship because they're Harvard. And so they just cherry pick the best early. And you don't then get, you know, a potentially like full ride scholarship from UChicago or something.
You just have no awareness either, because you've also preemptively not applied.
You can't get
anywhere into
Yale. You can't get into Stanford. You can't get a full ride from NYU or Columbia or Michigan or, you know, UVA or any, I don't know. There's like so many great schools that could pay you to go there, get a stipend to go to for free and a stipend. And you're not going to have any idea what these other offers are. Anyway, the second option, says Elijah, would be to wait another year and apply to a range of law schools as a senior to see my options. To be clear, if I did the first and was rejected, I would just go on to the second. Yeah. The heart of my question is the following. I live just outside of Boston and would likely want to practice in Massachusetts. Harvard is the best, or perhaps second best, school for the type of law that I am interested in practicing. And I mean, in Massachusetts, it has to be just the best at everything.
Yep.
Is it worth foregoing the scholarship offers that I might get if I waited and didn't apply to the junior deferral program? As is probably apparent, if I got into Harvard, I would obviously accept, despite the extra debt that I would accumulate relative to a school with a merit scholarship. I'm not trying to jump the gun by assuming I would get into anywhere, says Elijah with his 4.0 GPA and his 165 LSAT diagnostic.
From a top 20s undergrad, yeah.
Elijah, you're going to get in almost everywhere.
Yep.
Anyway, humbly, he says, I'm not trying to jump the gun by assuming I would get in anywhere. I'm just curious to hear what your thoughts are about these junior deferral programs that several T14 schools offer. Are they worth the trade-off of not seeing all of one's scholarship options? My gut says no.
No, I don't think so. You're really hyper-focused on Harvard. It might be the best option, but I think you're going to get into Harvard anyway.
Yeah, I mean, imagine like a football team, you know, looking at some like hot shit. Yeah, obviously the rules don't work this way, but imagine if a team was able to like look at a hot shit, just they, you know, it was like they play national high school football, like and they're just like a stud in their junior year of high school football. They're like dominating national high school football. And some pro team is just like, hey, tell you what, like, sign with us now. We're going to give you a rookie minimum contract and don't go to college. And then you'll guaranteed get to play for us for the league minimum.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
That's kind of what this is like, right? And it's like, no, but it's, oh, it's the Patriots. You get to, you know, it's like, yeah, I know, but they're going to want you after you dominate your senior year of high school and then go dominate in college. They're still going to want you. So why not try to sign for the big bucks instead of, I don't know. Yeah. Harvard's great and all, don't get me wrong, but I feel like you're a good enough applicant that they're going to want you anyway.
Yeah. And you could go to free to some amazing programs. I don't know. The 2-year thing too is a little strange, right? Like, okay, now I have to go work for 2 years. That could be a good thing for you, but why not 1 year?
Nothing's stopping you from doing that anyway.
Yeah.
It's just, you would have the option to do it instead of them telling you. I mean, it's so good for them that it almost has to be bad for you, right? It's like they're putting you in their schedule way in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah. Okay. Then might work out for me, but maybe I want to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, they can do it because they're Harvard, but I feel like you're a good enough applicant and you're a savvy enough applicant because you listen to us that I don't know that there's other ways. Like, you could end up getting into Harvard via the normal way, but you also could get some better offer from, yeah, because you're not getting a scholarship anyway. So what if you get into actual Yale, or what if you get into Stanford and decide that you'd like to get out of the winters for a little while? Or what if you get a full ride to some other kick-ass place? I don't know. This just doesn't seem that great to me.
Nope.
Unless you're really, really sure that you only want to go to Harvard. I guess I would do it if I was 100% like, yep, I'll go to Harvard no matter what. Then I guess I would do it. But how do you know that?
That's the thing. It's hard to make that decision until you have the other offers in front of you.
Yeah. You won't know how you feel if you foreclose all of those offers.
Hmm.
You won't know how you would have felt, right? I mean, you'll just be like, nah, it's Harvard for me. That's it.
I mean, Elijah does know what area of law he wants to practice. Talk to more people if you're really sure. Maybe it's worth it, but default presumption is no.
Default presumption is definitely no.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he says, I would likely want to practice in Massachusetts.
Mm.
What if not? What if you decide you don't like your family that much? What if you decide you don't like winter that much? What if you meet somebody that you really do like a lot and they're in Silicon Valley? What if, I don't know, a lot of what ifs. You're just closing off a lot of doors with this.
Yeah.
It's opening one real nice one. But yeah, closing too many others, I think.
I mean, and at some point you do have to close those doors. There's a lot of value in closing doors, but
yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
That's true. I mean, the counter argument is like, well, you can just stop even worrying about all this other bullshit.
Yeah.
And you could just if you're clear that you'll be happy going. I mean, God, but you're speaking for yourself 5 or 6 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that Harvard JD, by the way, you're going to be able to practice wherever you want. So it doesn't, like, you don't have to practice in Massachusetts. it's the best for practicing in Massachusetts, but you definitely don't have to practice in Massachusetts. But you are speaking for yourself, like, you know, because it's junior year, senior year, then 2 years of work, then 5 years from now, you're like saying, yes, I will start law school at Harvard Law 5 years from now. Yeah. And graduate from Harvard Law School 8 years from now.
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy to make those commitments about your future self. Email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.